This episode of the Out of Bounds podcast is brought to you by Fisher Skis.
Hi, everyone. This is episode number 60 with Chris Davenport. Before we get into the episode, I just wanted to thank a couple sponsors here and kind of give you guys some updates on some shit. We kind of like have taken like a week or two off. It's just been like super busy. It's also like, it's a lot harder than I think people give credit for to like do a podcast every week and like do it consistently. I think Warner was telling me from Low Pressure Podcast was telling me a while ago, like just doing it every week is a project. And I was like, no way. Like it is totally going to be fine. But like, it's a project, for sure. I guess we're going to get back on track here this week and hopefully continue that trend for the next few weeks. And then we'll be at Outdoor Retailer in middle of June, just doing interviews for like 4 or 5 days out in Denver. So if you know anybody that would like to be on the show, just hit us up. Email or Instagram DMs are the best way to hit me. It's just adam@outofpodcast.com. So definitely do that. If you have someone that you know will be in the Denver area or in Colorado in general, and we can make an interview work during, I think it's the 14th through the 20th or something like that, that I'll be out there. We've already got a couple people lined up. So we'll see how many more we can do. And hopefully that'll get us some good summer episodes from a great event. Outdoor Retailer, for those that don't know, is like basically, this is the summer market show. I go every year in the winter show just to look at like next year's winter gear. This is kind of similar. I've actually never been to the summer show. There used to be Interbike, which was like the winter outdoor retailer, or SIA as it used to be called, but they don't have that anymore. So we are doing summer market, see what that's like. And hopefully it goes really good. I'm just excited to go be in Denver for a little while. It's good to just get out of Western Mass. What else? Thank you to Sawatch Hemp for sponsoring this episode of the show. They make some of the best CBD products that exist, in my humble and not very experienced opinion. But I know this stuff works for sure. It's helped a ton as I was recovering from knee surgery. Like the salve is the one that I use the most. It's just like a rub on. It helps bring the swelling down, takes like the edge off the pain. I mean, it's been really good. It smells awesome. Kind of gives you like a little tingly feeling, like icy hot kind of. I love that stuff. You can go to their website and save 15% off your purchase using promo code OUTOFBOUNDS. It's just sawatch.co. Check those guys out for sure. I would also like to thank Burn Helmets for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Similarly, you can use promo code OUTOFBOUNDS to save 15% off your purchase of a new lid. Their stuff is awesome. I've been wearing a Burn helmet for a long time, and it's super comfortable. They use like the sink fit thing, so like basically your helmet just sits a little lower. That's for the ski helmets, but helmet just sits a little lower on your head. Doesn't look super dorky and bulbous like a lot of them do. Super clean. I mean, the stuff is great. It's a great crew of guys over there. Great group of people over there. For mountain bike stuff, I've been using the FL1 XC with MIPS. So that's kind of been my go-to helmet. Like if somebody's asking like, oh, what do I ride for a mountain bike helmet? That's the one that I've been using. And it works great. I mean, it protects my head and it's got MIPS in it, so it reduces the risk of concussion. And that's basically it. So let's get into this episode. Chris and I met up in New Hampshire, actually down the street from his childhood home, as he mentions. We just had a chat for a little while. I hit him up. He was actually doing some speaking at Tuckerman Brewing for Protect Our Winners. He was just doing a speaking engagement there, which is awesome to hear. There seems like Protect Our Winners is doing a ton of like smaller speaking events in different venues in different areas, and I think it's really important for sure. We met up at this random Airbnb inn thing, this like bed and breakfast. And it was like, I got the Airbnb, or the Airbnb, the Babe Ruth room. And it's like, there's like pillows and paintings of Babe Ruth and towels with Babe Ruth's face on it. And it was just like literally like 17 pictures of Babe Ruth. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm sure he's great and all, but it's a little weird. You're sleeping on a pillow with Babe Ruth on it, and you're also like looking at every picture with Babe Ruth on it, and it's like a little strange. So yeah, this is episode 60 with Chris Davenport. We talk about all kinds of stuff per usual. I'm sure you guys will enjoy it, and let us know what you think. Make sure you leave us a review on iTunes if you can. That helps the show a ton. But if you're listening on Spotify or whatever, just tell a friend to tell a friend. We'll keep growing the show. Awesome. Thank you, guys. And here is Chris Davenport. Who are you? What do you do? Tell the people a little bit
about yourself. Whoa, what's up, everybody? I'm Chris Davenport. I'm a pro skier. I wear a lot of hats in the ski industry, though. So when I say pro skier, I guess that people are like, well, what does that mean? Because it's been an evolution sort of throughout my career of different things that I've focused on. But I mainly these days am guiding, taking clients, skiing all over the world, still working with all of my sponsors, from Kessley Skis, Scarpa Boots, Spider Clothing, of course, Red Bull. I've been with them since the very beginning, Cliff Bar, Black Diamond, and Sweet Protection, Aspen Snowmass, some others, and doing product development, testing, and marketing. And then I do a lot of work with nonprofits. I try to give as much of my time as I can. I don't have a lot of free time, but I somehow seem to generate enough time to work with Protect Our Winters as a longtime board member. The Aspen Valley Ski and Snowboard Club is the vice president of the club. The American Institute for Avalanche Education, Research and Education, ARI, work closely with them. And I'm on the board of Holderness School, which is a boarding school, high school up in Plymouth, New Hampshire, where I went and ski raced at, and both of my two older kids go to, and actually graduations this weekend. My oldest son, Stian, is almost 18 and graduating from high school. So I'll be over in Plymouth later on this weekend. And yeah, gosh, that's kind of it in a nutshell in terms of like what I do these days. I do a lot of speaking engagements, corporate type stuff. Like I was in Chicago last week speaking at a big financial conference, which is fun. That those engagements help fill the off season and can be quite good money if you're in the right network. Also work with Outside Television, hosting a TV show on Outside TV. So yeah, God, a lot of different things. I basically like to stay busy. I like to hustle.
Yeah.
Being a pro skier means you're sort of like an independent contractor. You kind of are on your own. You know, you don't work for a company. You're not on a team, so to speak. Like if you played in the NFL or something like that, like you have to go create opportunities for yourself. Sometimes opportunities are created for you. Maybe they're through sponsors or events or different things, but I've definitely found that, this job, this career has been one of hustle. It's been one of having to go out there and make shit happen.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Like it's almost like when you look at it from the outside, it doesn't seem like a job even, but there's so much stuff that goes totally into it.
Well, it is, I mean, it is a job.
And yeah.
It's a dream job in many respects, at least for me, because I was a young kid growing up here in North Conway skiing, thinking to myself, and this actually happened. I was on the chairlift when I was 13 with a buddy of mine, Justin, and we were having so much fun. And I remember the conversation going something along the lines of, man, wouldn't it be cool if we could just ski every day for the rest of our lives? And that really stuck with me to the point that I figured out how I could do that. And now I ski 200 days a year and get paid to do it. So yeah, it's kind of cliche sounding, but it is living the dream. Although that dream comes with a lot of hard work and some sacrifice and a lot of risk. So
probably a lot of tedious stuff too. Like there's a lot of like,
maybe not as much now, but I guess when you're starting, and it seems like, so like what I've heard from some of the other people that we've had on the show too, is like a lot of the work is just like sitting and answering emails and like just,
oh, I hate that shit.
And the social media aspect of it now, like there's just a lot of stuff. There's just a lot of dumb stuff that like you would think, like it's not just about skiing, right?
Right. And that's, I mean, I guess that's true in every walk of life nowadays, and or in every, in all people's lives, most people's lives. There's a lot more of that digital frequency, and it, to me, it's just noise. You know, I hate my email, but it's an incredibly important tool for communication and strategy and just staying in touch with people and sponsors and clients and everything. And same with social media. It's a love-hate relationship. I mean, I like engaging with my fans. I genuinely enjoy answering questions and being a resource. But at the same time, I hate having to like feel like I have to feed that beast, feed that monster. And you know, it's something that, I mean, like literally in the last 6 months, I've probably looked at Facebook 3 times.
Yeah.
So I'm on there.
Yeah.
And I have a social media manager gal that I work with, and she handles that all. So I don't have to, and we sit down and have meeting, like editorial meetings, and decide what we want to, what I should be talking about or what I want to talk about in the social space. But I don't, my time is too precious. You know, I have 3 kids. I have an amazing wife. I have an awesome life. And I don't want to like dilute that by being absorbed by social media. I think it's just getting in the way of doing cool things. I'd rather be outside on my bike or skiing or climbing or doing, you know, something active.
Like actually doing something, you know, that you're talking about. Yeah. Like that's the crazy thing, I think, is like it, social media is a job at this point. Like that in itself is job within the job.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's people that do it really well, and and I try to do it fairly well, but at the same time, I could care less how many followers I have, or I just, you know, want it to be there so that I can check all the boxes with sponsors and make sure that I'm just, you know, doing the best job I can for them because they're paying me to represent their brands.
Yeah.
But I also do really enjoy art and photography. And so putting cool images, sharing that stuff online is fun. And it's fun to see people's reactions.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. How did you get into being a pro skier? Like, I don't think that's a job you just like sign up for. You definitely don't go to school for being a pro skier. Well, like, how did you start?
Back when I started, it wasn't a job. Yeah. I mean, I was like kind of, I'll call it second generation, just because the generation before me or before us was the Glenn Plake, Mike Hatrip, Scott Schmidt, you know, those guys that were in the Greg Stumpen movies and Warren Miller's, some of Warren Miller's movies that were actually some of the first pro skiers. I suppose you could go back even further in time to people like Jim McConkie, Shane's dad, or Stein Erickson, you know, in the 50s and 60s, these guys, were maybe not making a living professionally skiing, but they were pro skiers. So then my generation comes along, you know, Shane, as I mentioned, Kent Kreitler, Dean Cummings, Brant Moles, Seth Morrison, Wendy Fisher, people like that. And we were just kind of in the right place at the right time in the early 90s. I never thought about being a professional skier because it wasn't a thing. But I did, I did watch the movies, and I did think that that looked really cool. And that's, you know, I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. I want to jump off cliffs. I want to ski pow. I want to get in a helicopter. I want to fly around the world and ski good snow. And so to make kind of a long story of how I got into it shorter, after graduating from the University of Colorado, where I went after I left New Hampshire, I ski raced at CU and then quit ski racing and just went free skiing and I was really enjoying that. Shane McConkie, who I had known in high school because we were both ski racing, he was at Burke Mountain Academy in Vermont. I was at Holderness School in New Hampshire, and we would see each other on weekends at ski races. And we ended up as freshmen at CU together. And after I graduated, Shane had dropped out after his sophomore year and was delivering pizzas in Vail. But we stayed friends, even though we didn't see each other that much during those couple of years. He called me in 94. And said, hey, I'm going down to Crested Butte for the U.S. Extreme Skiing Championships with some friends. You should come join us. And I literally did not know what that was. So U.S. Extreme Skiing Championships? Like, okay, that sounds cool. Got some information. I, you know, there was no internet at the time. I couldn't really look it up. So I just, I don't know how I found out about it. But anyway, I registered and went down there and did the competition and was blown away. I felt like I had found my tribe. You know, I felt like I all of a sudden was with this group of people that resonated with me. And I loved meeting all these people. I loved the competition. I felt like, I can't remember how I did in that first one, but I felt like I had some advantage over people because I'd been competing and skiing already for most of my life. And so from that point on, I just was like, I'm going to keep doing these contests. I'm going to just try to see if I can't make something of this. And then won the world championship in 96 in Valdez, Alaska. And from that point on, it was like, all right, here's the opportunity. What are you going to make with it? And sort of wrote a proverbial business plan for myself of like sponsors or brands I wanted to connect with and wanted to work with, and a plan of what I was going to go do in, as far as working with film companies, and kind of put that all together. So 96, I would say would kind of be like the beginning of when I was actually making some money.
Yeah.
And then once I won the worlds, I stopped working a full-time job.
Yeah.
And just pursued being a pro skier.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it was not something that, there was a roadmap to success.
Yeah.
You had to kind of figure it out, but I had a great education. And I was savvy enough to see that there was opportunity written on this wall. If you know what I mean, it was like,
yeah,
you know,
I don't think it's just being a good skier either. Right. Like that's the thing that people are like, oh, I'm a better skier than that guy or that guy. But like, you kind of have to like put it all together.
Man,
right.
So half the listeners on this podcast are probably better skiers than I am. Yeah,
definitely better skiers than I am too. I mean, it's like, that's how it
but,
goes, man.
But being, it's not a race, you know, it's not like, this person is a faster cyclist or a faster runner or can climb a harder grade. There's not really any way to definitively say who's better than who, right?
Yeah.
Like I just found my own path and made it work. And if I call it the business of fun, I mean, I'm literally having a great time every day doing what I do
and
figuring out how to, make a living at it. That's been like the biggest trick is like not only following your passion, but turning that into a life-sustaining career. I feel like that's where I've won. That's where I've succeeded.
Yeah, and I think people want to hear like the number one question I think we get every time there's any pro on is like, how can I get sponsored? You know?
Yeah.
So like, how does somebody get sponsored? Right? Because people want to see that roadmap that doesn't exist. Totally. So like what?
And the roadmap does exist kind of now.
Yeah.
It just didn't exist back then. But I get that question from people all the time, especially young people, like, you know, 13-year-old boys who
13
are like,
to 15.
Dude, I want to be sponsored by Red Bull. What do I do?
Yeah.
And my answer is, first thing, go ski as much as you possibly can. You got to put in the time. You got to put in the hours. We've all heard the famous, you know, 10,000 hours analogy, that it takes that much to become great at something.
No.
I would argue it takes even more than that. And even if you do that, you may not have what it takes to become somebody that the industry sees as influential or relevant or important enough to get behind. And then when you do get sponsored, is it enough to get a free pair of skis or a jacket or, you know, some equipment, or is it $5,000? Are you a pro skier? At what point is it, you know, sustainable for you as an individual? You know, for me, I mean, I've got a family and kids going to private schools and college soon and all this stuff. Like, I'm not making a living at $50,000 a year. You know, you've got to push beyond and beyond. So that means you have to be an entrepreneur. You got to come up with new ways of creating a business and creating revenue for yourself, because it's, you know, especially once you're done competing, you know, if you're in the X Games and on, or on the Freeride World Tour and you're winning everything, well, no, Freeride World Tour is a bad example because there's no money there.
Yeah.
Those guys are winning like $7,000, but,
and they're ascending it. It's
exactly.
That's crazy.
So yeah, you got to figure out, okay, if you're not competing anymore, you certainly aren't making any money filming. You're actually spending money to be out with TGR or Matchstick or Warren Miller. That's coming out of your own sponsor budget, travel budget. So like, what does it mean to be a pro skier? And I would argue that unless you're actually making a real living, you're not a pro skier.
Yeah.
So it's really tough. You know, there's, especially nowadays, I think, again, going back to the 90s, when I kind of got into it, the industry was looking for new outlets and new ways to market itself. And these new free skiing or extreme skiing, as we used to call it, which is awful, but these new athletes that were doing this thing were the perfect outlet because they were using the same equipment that the consumers buy. It wasn't specialty gear like ski racers might be using or something. So that made a lot of sense. And yeah, we just went off down a little rabbit hole
on
the business side of it there. But it is really interesting. And everybody kind of figures out a way that works for them.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's no roadmap earlier. There's no like blueprint of how this is what you have to do to be a pro. You can figure that out on your own. You know what I mean? So when someone asks me that question, getting back to my answer is, one, you got to put in the time. Ski your ass off. If you love it enough and you can dedicate skiing every single day, dedicate every single day to skiing, then perhaps you're going to get to a point where you're good enough and you're smart enough and you've got the experience that brands will see some value in you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people want that like clear cut, like just tell me how to do it and I'll do what you tell me. And there's just like not really a way. I don't think there's a way to do that with anything, like unless you're like building a house and then like you can just, there's clear steps, you know?
Yeah. But it's like at saying, hey, I want to be a professional golfer. What should I do?
Yeah.
Well, like, just go golf. Play golf.
Yeah. Go golf.
So
yeah.
Obviously the answer is the same in skiing or surfing or any sport. If you want to be a pro, go do it as much as you possibly can. Surround yourself with people that are better than you, mentors, coaches, whoever, you know, so that you can learn and get experience. Save your money however you can, work as many jobs as you can so you can go on trips and experience what it's like in other parts of the world. Like, you have to get the experience.
Yeah. That's one of the best pieces of advice I think I ever got, especially when I was even younger. Like, it was like, you have to go ski with people that are better. You have to go ride with people that are better than you. You know, you have to see what other people, you can't just think like, oh, I'm good at this because somebody told me I was good at it. And like, that's the end all be all. You have to just go and just do it. Like, it's pretty simple, I guess. Right. Like, should be.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, the concept is simple.
Yeah.
But applying it's hard.
Yeah. So switching gears a little bit here. The ski industries, we were kind of talking about like sponsorship and all this stuff, but like the ski industry is changing, obviously. Mm-hmm. How do you think the health of the ski industry in general is? Because I don't know how I feel about it. Like, some days I feel really good about it. Mm-hmm. Like, I think everything's good. I think the ski industry is healthy-ish. And then some days I'm like, the ski industry is in the fucking shitter. Like, we're fucked. So how do you?
Yeah, I think we're somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
You know, I don't think we're fucked yet. But is it as healthy as it can be? Probably not. I mean, the ski industry has made some major challenges, and some of them are existential, meaning that they're things that are beyond our control. The first thing that comes to mind is dealing with our industry is completely dependent on snow and weather. You know, good snow, good weather, and with global warming happening, things are just more uncertain. You know, one year it might be great. Like, this year was generally a pretty great snow year across the country. Last year was terrible. And the economic impact of a bad snow year is really pretty devastating on the industry. Whereas the economic impact of a good snow year is helpful, but it's not that great that it sustains you through the bad ones. The bad ones are much worse than the good ones are good, if you know what I'm saying. So we have that risk, which we have to face, and the industry needs to adapt. Ski resorts need to come up with alternate or other ways to make money, whether it's summer operations or in events, things like that. Manufacturers need to start looking at diversifying. I mean, if you're a company that only makes skis and there's a few bad snow years in a row, you're gonna suffer. It's gonna hurt.
Yeah.
So diverse, you know, we see a lot of this happening where major companies like Amer Sports that owns Salomon and Atomic and Arc'teryx, and they were just purchased by a Chinese conglomerate. So there's all, and then of course what's happening in the resort business with Vail Resorts and Alterra, the Icon Pass, all the, you know, I mean, all of this consolidation, are, these are responses to economic pressures, climate pressures, you got to sort of diversify your product offering. So, okay, going back to, again, I'm not trying to like go down the rabbit hole of the business of it all, but these are major challenges in for the industry. And then we see the cost of skiing and snowboarding escalating. It's really prohibitive. I would love to see more opportunity for families and young people to have cheaper or more affordable access to the sport of skiing. And it's just not really happening. So
on that point, do you think this whole Alterra buying everything and Vail Resorts buying everything, do you think that's a good thing for that? Because the argument is that like it is Icon and all these passes do make things a little more affordable for people, I guess. But it's also like spreading everybody out and it's not making any one place really that healthy, I guess, you know? So it's, and you're also killing the really small resorts.
Yeah, it's a challenge. And I'm somewhere in the middle on that as well. I mean, I understand that that's the evolution of the business. It's just the road that we're going down and it's impossible to turn this ship around.
Yeah.
But you know, would I like to go back to the 60s or 70s when times were simpler? Yeah, sure. But I don't know. Skiing's awesome. And there's still lots of fun to be had out there. And
if you're going back to the 60s or 70s, you have the same skis as you had in the 60s and 70s too. And stuff's better now, you know, like there's pluses and minuses to all of it, you know?
Yeah, there absolutely is. You know, it's a great industry, but like any industry, it's got its challenges for sure. And all we can do is try to make it as affordable. I said that, but what's the word I'm looking for? Attainable for people. You know, I think at the end of the day, I want to keep people safe out there. I want people to have a good time. I don't want skiing to be thought of as this elitist sport that's only for people with lots of money.
It's only a white guy sport.
Or I mean, diversity, that's a whole nother challenge.
Yeah.
I have no answer to or figure that, solve that problem.
It's, I don't know.
It's socioeconomic.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Regional. I mean, there's lots of issues there. So, but we're not in the shitter. And this year was great. The numbers from the NSAA, National Ski Area Association, were solid. There was a lot of people. I think it was 52 or 53 million skier visits out there.
Yeah. Which sounds good.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what it was before, you know, so like
at the height of it was in the late 90s, actually. Then things dropped off, but no, it's generally pretty healthy.
And, good.
So.
Yeah. It the whole vibe I think has changed even from like when I was, and I'm 24. So like, it's not like I'm very experienced and I feel old for sure, but I'm definitely not old, you know, but even from when I was a kid skiing, it's a different thing. It's a different industry. So
how would you say it's different from when you were a kid? Because that's really not that long ago.
No, it's not that long ago. But already you can see like the local hills are not opening until, that's a climate change thing to some extent, I guess, too. But my local hills aren't opening until December, sometimes January. Yeah. Like they're not. And I mean, obviously, we're in a different area in Massachusetts and southern Vermont. But and the skiing's really not good until like February, and then the season's over in March. Yeah. So it's like your season's so much shorter. And on the retail side of things, like there were times when, and I guess the internet and all this stuff has something to do with it, but there were times when like it was just always busy all the time. And now it's like your ski season is really like for retail is essentially December, January, a little bit of February, and then you're on closeout, you know? Yeah. So it's like, it's a different, I don't know. It's just, even just that side of things is different.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what I was saying about diversification. And I didn't touch on the retail side of things. I was kind of just talking about like resorts and that business.
Yeah.
But if you're a ski shop and your season is, you know, say it's maybe people start buying stuff in October, November, December, and you got Christmas week. If you don't nail it at that time, you're in trouble. So if there's no snow, or it's, you know, pouring rain, then people aren't thinking about skiing, especially here in the Northeast. And it's tough on retailers.
Because I think the most important consumer group is like your weekend warrior, you know, like that really is, I think for retail and probably for the mountain too, like everybody complains every time there's like long live lines on the weekend or whatever, but those are the guys that kind of make it happen for the industry because I don't pay retail for anything. I'm assuming you don't pay retail for anything, you know? So as far as like the retail model goes, we're not the important ones. The important ones are the guys that are coming in. They need gloves. They need a hat. They need a pair of rental skis, you know?
Yeah.
Those guys don't ski when it's not good. Yeah. They ski when it's cold. They ski when it's, especially in New England, it seems like they go, a lot of those people go skiing when they're like, fuck it, there's nothing else to do, you know? Yeah. So that's important. It's so, I mean, that's where the industry's at, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sort of an optimist by nature. So I think, you know, I think generally, at least in the short term, things will be fine. Long term, you know, a generation or two from now, I tend to get a lot more pessimistic. I think we are indeed fucked by the actions of humanity on this planet. It's going to be really bad in the future. And which is why, you know, I work closely with Protect Our Winners and advocate for policy changes and things that will hopefully allow our industry to thrive in the future rather than be destroyed by something that we could have controlled.
How long have you been working with Pow?
So Jeremy Jones founded Pow in 2008, so 11 years ago. I joined the board of the organization in 2012.
Okay.
So I've been on the board for 7 years and
awesome.
Helped steer that ship through some times where we were really small and through a big period of growth in the last few years where now we've got 13 full-time employees and a great budget with which we can activate on and get people out and about at events and to Washington, D.C. to deal with our elected officials and try to make sure that they're using common sense and are set in the right direction.
For people that like want to donate but aren't sure what they're donating to, what does Pow actually do? You know, I know you touched on some of it by like going to DC
and talking
about it, but like what's the point?
Right.
You know, what does that money do?
The goal is to mobilize the outdoor industry to advocate for policies that are good for our livelihood, that are good for our way of life. You know, every industry has advocacy groups or lobbying groups or groups that look out for the well-being or health of that industry, and Protect Our Winners is that group for the outdoor industry. If doesn't matter if you're a skier, a climber, a runner, a cyclist, or hey, even a hunter, or you know, somebody who just likes hiking in the woods, you want a healthy planet, you want a healthy climate, you want a stable climate, you want to prevent things from getting more weird, if you will. And so we do all sorts of different things from the advocacy that I mentioned with our elected officials, and that can be at the local level, the state level, or the federal level. We do these lobbying trips to Washington, D.C. We meet with governors and state senators and congressmen. We get together on local issues that will affect climate and or the industry. We send out our huge Riders Alliance, over 100 professional athletes, to do educational events at schools. That might be grade schools, high schools, universities, sharing their passion, but giving it a sense of purpose. At the end of the day, we all want to contribute something to make society better. And I feel certainly like we've been led down this path especially by the fossil fuel industry with misinformation, lies, denials, skepticism, all of this stuff that's complete BS, yet people believe. And so it's our job to be truth tellers and speak truth to power. And it's our job to stand up for this way of life. I mean, like the valley that we're sitting in right now, Mount Washington Valley, it's a beautiful, one of the most beautiful parts of New England. Great recreational opportunities, a big business with the ski industry up here. And a lot of people's livelihoods depend on that. Their jobs depend on that. And so when you have bad winters or no snow, especially if it's back-to-back years, it can be devastating on local economies. So we try to just, as an organization, give people the tools, a roadmap, if you will, to make good decisions.
And how can people get involved if they want to?
Yeah, so just go to protectourwinners.org. There's a climate activist roadmap on there, which is basically like a set of tools that will help you find your biggest lever, because we all have different ways that we can get involved. Maybe you work for a company that can reduce its own greenhouse gas emissions, or perhaps make a contribution to a political candidate who is making good decisions when it comes to environmental policy. Maybe you have a outsized social media influence, and you can use that as a lever to share information with people. So that roadmap on the website has tons of information about how you can get involved. But the most important thing that people can do is not recycle or put solar panels on their house. Those things are great, especially the solar side of it. But the most important thing you can do is vote. Vote for the environment. Vote for candidates that are going to back legislation that allows for green, renewable energy projects, things like that. That's the most important thing by far.
Okay.
Yeah.
We obviously that didn't happen quite as much this past go around. But
no, I mean, there's the you know, not to get political, the country has lots of issues.
Yeah.
You know, it's issues with healthcare, it's issues with race, it's issues, you know, just ingrained in the political process right now, as we see at the highest levels of government. And I mean, it's a total shit show at the moment, and we lack really good leadership. I would argue that we're going down a path that's not good, and so. I'm going to use whatever influence I have gained over the years as an athlete to try to make the world a better place.
So on that point, how do you feel about all the, cause there's a lot of this, like, especially at like the very high level of athletes, like the LeBron Jameses of the world and stuff, where it's like, just shut up and dribble, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Right. Have you seen that, where it's like, basically like your opinion really only matters if we're talking about skiing?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that side of things? Because it seems like those are people that don't really care, obviously, about this, or they care just to get whoever they want in office. But
I think that that's really sad and too bad. I mean, I think that if you care about something and you're passionate, you should use your voice.
Yeah.
And that's what a democracy is all about. We're supposed to stand up for what we believe in. And so, I mean, if I post something on Instagram that's remotely environmental or you know, talking about climate, I get a bunch of haters that'll make comments saying, you know, stick to skiing, we follow you, and I'm so too bad. You know, I'm either gonna block you or, you know, don't follow me.
There's an unfollow button.
I have a voice and I'm gonna use it, and I could care less what other people think, because I know that it's right. I know that it working towards a healthier planet, healthier society, is the right thing to do. And I am not going to shut up about it. And I'm not going to be told by skeptics or haters that I'm wrong, because I know I'm not wrong. The science is clear, and I'm sticking with it. So if you don't like it, you can suck it.
That's the right attitude to have, I think. It's seriously, like, it is.
Hey, and the other thing is, you know, I'm a parent, and I want to set a good example for my children. And being confident in what you believe in is a good trait. And I like to show my kids I'm not afraid of speaking my mind. And if it means getting beat up online, so be it. I could care less.
None of those people that say shit like that online would do that in real life anyway. Like, they do it. They're just internet trolls.
Yeah,
like
probably not. Doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah, but those comments always make their way there. So it's good to address that every once in a while, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's do some Instagram questions.
Love it.
Got quite a few for you. Do as many as we can until my phone dies.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm not real good at charging it, like, I guess. I'm at like 5%, so we'll see how many we can rattle off.
Okay.
Well,
thanks, everybody, for sending in questions.
Insta Greg O wants to know, have you had any close calls? What did you learn from them?
Yes, definitely have had close calls. And you always learn from mistakes or failures. In fact, I would say that people, humans, rarely learn any lessons when they do things right. They generally learn when you do things wrong, or at least you should. So I've been in a few avalanches, mostly while filming. And mostly it was just me making bad decisions and pushing because the camera was pointed at me. And I learned that that's a serious red flag for me, is when I am vulnerable to poor decision making is typically when I'm trying to push the limits for a ski film or something. And so I don't really do that anymore. I went for a couple pretty big rides in avalanches, was buried in the avalanche while it was moving on one occasion, but then ended up coming out on the surface at the bottom. So never been fully buried at the end of a slide, but seen black and been under the snow, and it's super scary. I've had some, had some good falls, tumbles, cartwheels, tomahawks, down mountains. That's going to happen. These things happen, and I don't beat myself up over it. I don't really, I debrief with myself and my team, and we talk about what decision, what series of decisions went wrong to lead to that, so that hopefully you don't make that mistake again. But it's like if you're a race car driver, it's not if you get in a car crash, it's when you're going to crash. Yeah. And if you're a professional skier or just someone who skis a lot, you don't have to be a professional skier. If you're a backcountry skier, you're going to come across avalanches at some point, especially if you're trying to push and you're out in the mountains a lot. It's just part of the equation, if you will. Another example I would use is that you could be the smartest poker player in the world. You are going to lose a hand at some point.
Yeah.
So then this gets into an entire discussion about risk and consequence. If you're going to push, you have to understand what the consequence of screwing it up is going to be. Right. So I'm totally fine with taking a lot of risk when there's low consequence. I am not fine with taking any risk when the consequence is death.
Yeah.
Right. So if you think about just that equation and you ask yourself on top of every line, if I totally screw this up, what's the worst that can happen to me? And that answer is I'm going to die.
Mm.
You might want to reconsider exactly what it is that you're doing.
Yeah.
Or just be sure that you have checked all the boxes and made the right decision and you're feeling good about it and you're listening to your intuition and your partners. Because I might have certainly skied no fall zones and did it confidently, but you don't want to spend too much time in the no fall zone in life in general.
Mm.
It'll bite you at some point. And I've lost dozens and dozens of friends over the years, every year it seems like. And I don't want to, I've made it this far. I'm not going to be joining that list.
Yeah. You got kids and a family. It's important to.
Man, I like living.
Yeah. Yeah. That alone. Yeah.
So, anyway, thanks for your question, Greg. It's a good one. Close calls, they do happen. And again, just make sure that the consequence is low.
All right. Alex Armstrong wants to know, do you have a favorite line from the 50 Classic Descents book?
Nice, Alex. Thanks for that one. 50 Classic Descents book is awesome. By the way, Adam, do you have one?
No.
What?
No, I don't.
Well, that's good because I brought you one.
Cool. And beautiful.
I'll sign it for the shop.
Awesome. That sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah. 50 Classic Descents of North America is a coffee table book that I, along with two friends in Aspen, wrote, 8 years ago now. And it chronicles 50 beautiful ski descents. It's not the 50 best. It's not the 50 most beautiful. It's just a collection of 50 great descents in North America. You can get it at 50classicskidescents.com. And I have a few favorites in the book. The first one that stands out is probably the Mesner Couloir on Denali. Mm-hmm. It's on North America's highest peak. It's 5,000 vertical feet of sustained 45, maybe pushing 50 in spots. It's big, it's long, it's gorgeous, and it's high in altitude. And when I skied it, it was like on literally the most perfect evening on Denali, with sun, kind of not sunset, but evening light with a great crew. And that one stands out as a very memorable. The other two I would add is Pyramid Peak, which is a very difficult 14,000 foot peak right outside of Aspen. We stare at the line from Aspen Highlands all the time. And I made the second or perhaps third descent of that line in 2006. And that one stands out because it's just, again, big, steep, direct, technically very difficult climbing. At least at the time it was. That glass ceiling has now been completely shattered, and it's getting done a lot more and more. But and then the third one I'll add, just because I'm sitting here in North Conway, is Tuckerman Ravine. I mean, it's where I grew up, and I first skied it when I was probably 11 or 12. We would go there every year with my family, and I have some incredible memories from it, and I still love going back there. I was up there a couple weeks ago. It was awesome. And so, yeah, that's another, you know, East Coast favorite of mine. And
it's a classic.
Yeah. And for those of you that don't know, I'm sure many of you do, Cody Townsend, the pro skier from Squaw Valley, is trying to ski all of the 50 of the 50 classic ski descents in the book. And he's on, I think, 20 right now.
Yeah, he's a fucking...
And then another pro skier, Noah Howell from Salt Lake City, is also working on that project, and a little bit more quietly than Cody is. Cody's dropping all these fantastic video edits and episodes, and but it'll be interesting to see if either of these two skiers can finish it, because there's some really difficult ones in there. And when we thought up the list, we talked to people from all over the country and all over North America to get a lot of feedback on like what peaks would fit in there. But we wanted to have some really easy ones, and we wanted to have some really difficult ones. Not so that people wouldn't try the project or not. We weren't thinking about that at all. It was more just like, here's a gamut of different types of skiing, from expeditionary, you know, high altitude, really difficult ones, to ones that you can go do in your backyard on any given day. So yeah, Alex, thanks for that question. Those are all good. 50classicskidescents.com. That's the book. If we weren't on a podcast, I'd hold one up and show it to you, but I don't really
can't see it anyway.
Can't see it anyway. You can put it up in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely will. All right, let's see what else we got here. How was your Everest experience?
My Everest experience was incredible. I climbed and guided Mount Everest in 2011. I had had a client of mine who I started skiing with in Aspen, just on the ski resorts, and then that led to some backcountry skiing and doing some Colorado 14ers, and that led us to go climb Denali together. And literally in the tent at base camp after summiting Denali, he's like, what do you think about going to Everest next year? And a huge smile went across my face, and I was like, hell yeah, I will do that with you. And so we worked with him on some more skills and got ready and took him to Mount Everest. And people say, well, how do you guide Everest if you've never been there? Well, I had been to the Himalaya already a number of times. As a guide, just like if you're a teacher or a carpenter, you can kind of do that skill anywhere. So as a mountain guide, I can take people climbing anywhere or skiing anywhere in the world. You just use the same set of skills. You don't necessarily, and in fact, I would say Everest is a very easy mountain to guide, because there's fixed ropes going basically from base camp to the summit. So you're constantly kind of climbing on a route that's well established. You're not having to make decisions about where to go. So we had a great experience. Of course, I brought my skis, because why wouldn't you? And totally lucked out with amazing snow, was able to ski a good part of the Lhotse face, which is kind of the big steep face leading from camp 2 up to the South Col, high camp on Mount Everest. And myself and another guide, Neil Beidelman, we skied the Lhotse face in perfect snow conditions. So that was a highlight, one of my favorite ski descents I've ever done. And Effie, my client who I was guiding, did great. We got to the summit on a perfect cloudless, windless morning, climbed through the night, summited at like 7:30 in the morning, and it was fantastic. And before I left Aspen, my wife, the last thing she said to me is, Chris, whatever you do, don't fucking call me from the summit. I don't think she dropped the F-bomb, but she said, don't call me from the summit. Call me when you get back down. You know that the lesson there is, summit's only halfway.
Yeah.
Summit doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Getting down is what matters. So I definitely recall, you know, being at the top, being like, okay, we've tagged this. We got to get down. We spent like 45 minutes up there. It was gorgeous, cold, but you know, fine. And then we got out of there, and it was awesome. So it's a a great experience. I have a whole Everest slideshow that I do oftentimes with corporate groups when I talk about risk management from a professional standpoint, and they find it really compelling. It's an amazing place, and I would totally go back if I had the right client that wanted to go and, you know, pay me to take them up there. I would do it again.
Yeah, it's. And I think people forget about the down. Like that's the thing. Like everybody's like, completely. I want to summit. Yeah. Completely. I want to summit Everest, you know?
Yeah. The summit, but the summit down. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, the summit is what everybody thinks about. That's they funny. Want to say they climbed Everest. They want to tag the summit. And if you're out of gas at the top, you're done.
That's it.
Like you're going to die.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you've crossed the finish line is not on top of the mountain. The finish line is at the bottom of the mountain. And my wife so poignantly pointed that out. And so I think if I ever write an autobiography or something, it'll be called Don't Call Me From the Summit.
Yeah. And that one was from Patricia Witt.
All right, Patricia. I love it. You ever want to talk about Everest some more, or if you're interested in more details, get a hold of me. Steep Skiing on Instagram.
Steep Skiing. He doesn't like Instagram, though, so whatever.
That person doesn't?
You don't.
Oh, no. I mean,
it's okay.
No, I just don't like the concept of social media in general.
Oh, okay, yeah, cool.
I'm not Instagram's calling fine. Out Instagram. All right, cool. I actually do... don't like Facebook. I actually hate Facebook. Yeah. Instagram, I don't mind. But yeah.
What do you like about Instagram more than Facebook? Like what's the difference?
It's less people complaining and negativity and just bullshit. And, you know, I don't know, more people just interacting with each other, I guess. I don't know.
All right. Last one, I think. For the Hunt wants to know, what was your favorite East Coast ski experience growing up?
I mean, Tuckerman's is the obvious, Tuckerman Ravine is the obvious answer, just because that was the only kind of cool thing I did skiing on the East Coast, I guess. But I mean, I was a ski racer growing up here in Mount Washington Valley at Mount Cranmore, first at Mount Cranmore and then at Attitash and then at Holderness School. And so I got to ski all over New England and New York and Massachusetts going to ski races. And I always liked going to new ski areas and checking them out. And, I have one funny story. We were up at a ski race. I think it was at Burke Mountain and our coach was doing donuts in the parking lot in the van, after the race and hit like a dry spot and flipped the van.
Oh.
And the front windshield broke and popped out. And we were able with a whole bunch of people, we were able to push the van back up on its wheels. But drove home with our helmets and goggles on with no windshield. And again, this is back in the 80s, but can you imagine doing that now?
Yeah.
You'd go to jail.
That'd be a viral video on Instagram for sure.
Yeah. That was a good experience.
That's awesome.
A bunch of little Groms in the back of a beat up van coming back from a ski race.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this, dude. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I again, like I said in the beginning, I love talking about skiing, and there's a lot more we could have gone into.
Yeah.
But for all your listeners out there, hit me up on social media if you want to continue the conversation or learn some more or come out and ski. Like I said, I guide people all over the world, Japan, Alaska, Canada, ski camp in Chile every August, the Alps every spring.
You do that thing here in Portillo. I forgot about that.
Like, that's Superstars awesome. Camp in Portillo.
That's awesome.
Coming up.
That's
I've got it's actually almost sold out for a few more spots, but if you want to ski in Chile in August with Ingrid Backstrom, Cody Townsend, Mike Douglas, Wendy Fisher, and myself, come join us. Superstars Camp.
And that place is the shit, it's man. So I cool. talk about that place all the time.
Like, have you been?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucking nice.
Awesome. Yeah.
Nice,
that man. Place is a trip.
Yeah,
for
it's
sure.
Legit. It's legit.
What's that guy's name? What's the host guy's name? I forget his name.
The owner?
No.
Oh, Felipe. Yeah, Felipe Lopez.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, that dude's the shit.
The cruise director.
Yeah. He's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah. Felipe. He's a good dude. Cheers to Felipe.
Shout out Felipe.
Yeah. Awesome. Right on, Adam. Thanks for having me. And,
anytime, man.
Yeah.
All right. We'll talk to you guys soon. Bye.
All right. That was episode number 60 with Chris Davenport. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Be sure to follow Chris on social media at Steep Skiing for Twitter and Instagram. It's Chris Davenport on Facebook. Check out the book. The 50 Classic Lines is an awesome book. He actually left us a copy and, like you said, he was gonna, and I've been kind of poking through it bit by bit. It's a good table read for sure. So check out his stuff. And next week we're going to have a gear talk on Monday. I don't think we're going to have a regular episode. I think it's going to be a gear talk. So if you're not a gear nerd or don't want to hear me mumble into a microphone for an hour, it's probably not the best episode for you. But if you want to hear about bike shit for a little bit, I'm basically going to be talking about the new Santa Cruz Chameleon Carbon, the one that I've been riding, and the Santa Cruz 5010, which we've done one before on, but I'd like to touch on a couple more points on it since I've kind of basically, like, this will be our long-term review of that bike. Since I've had it for a year now on the new variation of it, and can actually kind of give you some solid feedback instead of like, yeah, I rode it with like basically a repaired ACL and like very gingerly riding it like I did on the first review. Now I like have ridden it pretty hard and I definitely have some thoughts. So tune into that. That'll be next Monday. And we're going to try to keep on a consistent schedule here and put them out on Mondays, for the next few weeks and kind of see how that goes. If you have questions, comments, concerns, anybody you'd like to see on the show, things you'd like to hear us talk about, gear you'd like us to review, thoughts you have, any of that shit, I don't give a fuck about it. Just kidding. You can hit us up, hit me up on email. It's just adam@outofpodcast.com, or hit me up on Facebook or hit us up on Instagram, whatever you want. I'm super psyched to hear from you guys. Always. And I'd really, really like to hear your opinions on things. It's always good to get a different perspective for sure. Other than my own, which obviously like can get pretty thick in the head sometimes. All right, that's it. I'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks. Bye.